So, okay, here's how it went down. On October 5th, Netflix released a new Dave Chappelle comedy special called The Closer, complete with a promo voiced by Morgan Freeman.
He looks as if he's about to say something. What could he possibly have left to say?
You shut up, Morgan Freeman!
Now, people tuned in to watch because, you know, he's Dave Chappelle. I mean, he's the comedian who brought us some of the most memorable comedy of all time. Now, in my very inexpert opinion, the Chappelle Show skit, I Know Black People, is quite possibly a perfect TV comedy sketch.
Why did black people distrust Ronald Reagan?
Because he was white?
That is correct.
Because he took all his money?
That is correct. Why did black people distrust Ronald Reagan?
He wasn't supposed to be trusted in the first place.
He is correct.
But when viewers tuned in on October 5th, they didn't get the edgy, sharp nuance of those unforgettable Chappelle Show skits. Instead, Dave Chappelle seemed angry, kind of whiny, small, and mostly, I think, just plain unfunny. Now, he did deliver punchlines in that unmistakable Chappelle tone, but The Closer, well, it sounds more like a rant than a routine.
It's not funny! It's not funny! It's not funny when you pull off an incredible caper! You thought you got over, next day you're in the paper! It's not funny.
And it's a rant with a clear target. Transgender people.
They don't hate transgender women, but they look at trans women the way we blacks might look at blackface. It offends them. Like, ooh, this doing an impression of me.
Seriously, y'all, Dave Chappelle was so singular in his unrelenting abuse of transgender folk that I started to think he was running for a seat in the Texas state legislature.
Oh, rim shot!
But to be clear, many loved it. On Rotten Tomatoes, Chappelle's The Closer had a 96% positive rating with ordinary viewers. Among professional TV critics, the rating is a measly 43% Rotten Tomatoes. And this gap for me, this is where it gets really interesting. So how should we understand this profound perceptual difference? By one reading, this is about an overthinking, out of touch, self-proclaimed, woke minority trying to impose unrealistic, politically correct discourse values on everybody else. But there's something else here. Cutting across this culture clash narrative of free speech, comedic artistry, political correctness, and elite discourse is an older and far more simple divide: race. It's possible to read Dave Chappelle's newest special and the uproar that has followed as a masterwork performance art project displaying both the limits and the reach of black male privilege. For example, Jacqueline Moore, a white trans woman and former showrunner of the hit Netflix series Dear White People, said she would no longer work with Netflix as a result of their decision to release and defend The Closer. As a result, Moore has received personal, vile, and violent anger and abuse in social media. And much of it is racialized. And if you want kind of a summary, it gets simplified something pretty close to, how dare a white woman, cis or transgender, speak against a black man? Even if he is a multimillionaire with a massive global platform, as a black man, he's inherently endangered, and the criticisms of a queer white woman are inherently invalid. It's an argument that Chappelle anticipates in the special and delivers as a punchline.
You know, a lot of the LGBTQ community doesn't know the baby's history. He's a wild guy. He once shot a nigga and killed him in Walmart. Nothing bad happened to his career. Do you see where I'm going with this? In our country, you can shoot and kill a nigga, but you better not hurt a gay person's feelings.
So do you see what he did there? By this logic, there are black people and there are queer folk. And in a nation where the lives and labors of black people are ignored, maligned, and endangered, black folk have free rein to ignore queer folks' pleas for humanity, security, and justice.
It's not funny.
Which means Chappelle is not only guilty of mediocre comedy, he's guilty of bad logic. Because see, black folk and queer folk are not separate communities. They're overlapping, intersecting, and enmeshed. I'm Melissa Harris Perry, and that intersection is where we begin today on The Takeaway.
It's not funny!
We're talking with Araya Lester, Deputy Director of the Transgender Strategy Center. Araya, welcome.
Hi, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So let's begin at the intersection of Black and queer identities. What are some of the specific vulnerabilities of Black trans women?
Oh, the Black trans women, I always say, are on the lowest rung of our societal ladder, not only here in America, but pretty much worldwide. When you're looking at the racial intersectionality, myself being a Black woman of trans experience, and I kind of say that because the Black comes first, right? Mm. That's the first thing that someone notices about a person is their physicality. And so the movement, the civil rights movement, is relatable to the LGBTQ movement. But in essence, even within that movement, the trans community is so far behind that in essence, it has become one of the oppressed communities that we saw within the prior to the 50s and 60s here in America for Black and African American communities.
It always feels to me like one of the most profound challenges of intersectional work in community is this question of the sources of violence and vulnerability. So for both trans and cisgendered Black women, there is vulnerability to state violence, right? Just as there is for cisgendered Black men. But there is also profound vulnerability to violence from Black people, from people in the community.
Mm-hmm. It's like our community is almost being mentally tricked, not by one entity or by one person, but by the retelling of certain stereotypes and paradigms that we see. One, our example of power since the institution of this country has been white, male, heterosexual, cisgender. And so this cis heteronormative type of look with that white overlay on it is what we as a people has always seen as the face of power. And so when you're looking at the direct opposite of all of those, the direct opposite of white is Black, man is woman, cisgender is transgender, you know, you just come down to the Black trans woman. And so you don't see as much violence against trans masculine individuals within the Black community, although it does happen. And I don't want to take away from the things that our trans masculine siblings go through. But yeah, there's almost like a reflex of, oh, you took away a piece of our power from as a community by identifying yourself as something that is directly opposite to what we see as power in America. And unconsciously, there's a backlash. And so we see a lot of interpersonal and community harm and violence against Black trans women in particular.
All right. Thank you so much for that insight. I've been puzzling over what is at stake. Like, as I watch the Chappelle special, I get, there's a part of me that was like, what is cultivating this anger? What is it that this person sees at being so at stake around the identity of Black trans women? But I feel like you just helped me to identify it, that it's about as though Black women of trans experience are pulling away the little bit of patriarchy or male privilege that exists within a still marginalized, you know, racial community.
Yeah. I mean, we don't see that with white trans women. You know, they don't go through the same violence and barriers from their own community, that because, you know, white people have it made. And so you have the first trans billionaire is a white trans woman, you know, And look at Caitlyn Jenner and just all of the privilege that just comes with that, with the racial ethnic type of identity. I see it in that person's eyes when they look at me when I'm in streets and I come across my community and have to hear hateful things. You know, it's almost like they take a personal offense. And where is that personal offense coming from? But from a lack of power and a lack of access.
This is also a moment when lawmakers, legislation is actually introducing new legal barriers, particularly for trans children and young people, you know, setting records for the number of anti-transgender bills that are being introduced. And I'm wondering about sort of these cultural moments like the Chappelle closer happening at the same time that this legislation is being introduced.
Well, we've seen this before. Back in the late 1800s, remember the minstrel shows? You know, they were a form of comedy that really stereotyped and lampooned and put down Black individuals in the Black community under the guise of comedy. And at that same time, there was a rhetoric being put out there that Black men were dangerous for your white women and for your children. And what are we seeing now? The exact same thing with trans individuals, to where we're used as the punching line and punching bag within comedy specials. And then at the same time, there's a fear-mongering that's being created politically and using the trans community as a scapegoat to kind of put pressure on the insecurities that we feel and the lack of knowledge that we have as a nation for trans people, the same way of what happened in the past with us as Black people. And I just don't see how people aren't seeing it.
Oh, Araya, what you just did there is so powerful, because that minstrel show or blackface, I mean, Chappelle actually describes the trans experience as though it is blackface and says, oh, it's about impersonating womanhood. And for you to invert that and actually show that, no, it's actually quite the opposite, right? It's about the vulnerability of bodies that are on the margins.
Yeah, and our bodies are the most vulnerable. You know, just a few years ago, the life expectancy for Black trans women was the age of 35, you know, and that's just due to murder and violence and high rates of HIV and sexual assault and murder because of just our community is against us. Of course, society is against us. Even our own families are against us. So it just kind of all sets us up to not be able to even live long here.
I want to talk for a moment about Daphne Dorman, who Chappelle references directly. And as I hear you talk about the cultural and the familial and the community rejection, can you tell us a little bit about Daphne's story?
Daphne, well, there's a post by one of Daphne's best friends, Mia Satya, on Facebook, who I am friends with and spoke at the First National Trans March here in D.C. Daphne was a comedian who, you know, it seemed that Dave kind of utilized her, you know, for his own efforts and his own kind of claim to fame in a sense. And as we see, Daphne's story was used by Dave in the last special. And not long after that, Daphne took her life. Unfortunately, we don't know the exact reason why, but the timing was very telling. And from what was told in that Facebook post, Dave Chappelle never reached out after the death, never sent any condolences, never did any type of acknowledgement until this special. You know, and to see exactly how Daphne has been portrayed, you know, after such a colorful and amazing life, and then such a horrible end to it, that I don't see how that storyline can be used in any type of way of comedy. And that's what we see, period, around the across the line for trans women. You know, our deaths are laughed at and overlooked. And there's a lot of victim blaming for everything that we do. And it's just really sad that, you know, Daphne was not someone that they felt the need to really, you know, address the death of, but yet you're going to use her story for something that's so hurtful and creates so much miseducation at a time that we're trying to educate the masses on what it means to be human, basically, you know, and what it means to have basic respect and empathy for each other and understanding that we're all individuals and we're all just trying to figure out ourselves within this life. And as a Black person, you know, trying to figure out ourselves and having to navigate a system that's not built for us. And what I think Dave is doing is just feeding into that system, you know, and not knowing that it was built by our oppressors and therefore it's not going to work for us. I think Frederick Douglass, when he talked about the Mitchell shows, he said that it was a way to pander to the corrupt taste of their white fellow citizens. And this is a pandering to the corrupt taste of America that we see now after our racial kind of George Floyd disputes and everything we've been through. And to come to now for Dave as a Black man to just take a community and just push them down even further and hold down our proverbial necks is just, I'm just really lost as to the whys.
Araya, you said something powerful here, many things powerful, but when you just said we're talking about what it means to be human. So what I want to do as we come to the end of our conversation, I want to pull back up to that humanity, which always means we are more than simply the sum of the oppressions that we survive. Talk to me about the work of the Transgender Strategy Center or about the joyous, beautiful community that you and so many other Black women of trans experience are building despite the hate.
Well, at the Transgender Strategy Center, you know, our goal is just trans liberation and specifically elevating the liberation of our Black family within our transgender, non-conforming, and non-binary communities, because what we need is fighters, you know, and so we go out, we go to corporations and we help them learn what it really means to be human, basically. You know, we all come into this world kind of knowing what we're comfortable in, our clothing, our favorite colors, our favorite games. And then as we go through school and we go through society, we then learn what is expected of us that may be quite different to what we know is innate. And we all have that experience, trans or not. And so myself and my organization really tries to teach corporations on how to intertwine that within their rhetoric, within their policies and procedures and onboarding for employment, and also helping our community in building up leadership development, capacity building, technical assistance, and assisting trans-led organizations who are really helping those who, you know, are still facing that 35-year life expectancy and trying to make it to where we're able to retire and grow old. We're assisting them with grant making and funds and helping them just learn how to navigate this world to where, you know, you're going to have a lot of more Dave Chappelle specials and a lot more anti-trans legislation and just learning what we can do to combat it and to further educate America and the world into just becoming better people.
Araya Lester, Deputy Director of the Transgender Strategy Center, thank you for your work, your empathy, and your voice.
And thank you for yours, Melissa.
I want to switch gears just a little bit and talk more about comedy. Because I just want to say, I'm not at all against comedy that pokes fun at aspects of the transgender experience. Flame Monroe is a transgender Black comedian who I find hilarious. She reflects on potentially terrifying moments of transgender vulnerability, like being stopped by a traffic cop who is likely to ask for a driver's license, a license which will reveal a gender and name that don't match her self-presentation. But Flame makes it funny, inverts the power, and still manages to teach us a little something about the challenges of living as a Black trans woman.
He said, excuse me. I said, I'm sorry, officer. Is there a problem? He said, yes, ma'am, you were speeding. I said, oh, I'm sorry, officer. I'm running late for work. I promise to slow down. He said, well, hold on, pretty girl. Hold on. I said, ooh.
See, this inversion, the surprise, this playfulness with the self, that is what I love in comedy. To help me think more about the comedic aspects of Dave Chappelle's The Closer, I talked with Mix Dahlia Bell, a writer and comedian who penned a letter in The Guardian to Dave Chappelle. It's entitled, Dear Dave Chappelle, transgender comedians can take a joke, but why are yours so unfunny? I asked Dahlia, what do you find funny? Like, what cracks you up?
When someone says something I've never heard before. It's the element of surprise. So you're bracing yourself for one thing, and then they throw this other thing at you. And especially if it's a perspective that only they could possibly give you, I think is what makes the joke legendary.
Got it. I love that. And it's, you know, because I was trying to think about this myself, like, what do I find funny? And I suspect, I think it's a little bit of both what you've said here, and this is, again, just for me, is both that I want it to be surprising, but also familiar, right? Like, for me, something probably cracks me up the most, I just think in my day-to-day life, when it's a little bit of an inside joke, but then also, like, a completely surprising spin on it. I probably actually can't find things funny if I have no reference point for them, right? So I like Southern jokes. I like Black jokes. You know, I like more and more these days, I like old lady jokes as I age. And I don't think in my 20s, I would have at all thought that, you know, jokes about your 50-year-old body were funny, but they're hilarious to me now.
You know, and I would agree with you, but I think one of the challenges for a comedian is being able to make the unfamiliar feel familiar. I mean, obviously, I'm coming at this from the perspective of a very, very queer comic. So it is a challenge that I had to overcome in order to do what I do. Because I have to make jokes that are written specifically for queer people, because it's the only context I have, funny and accessible and digestible for straight cis people.
When you're writing jokes, are you thinking of it that way? Or are you, again, I'm just sort of interested in the creative process. And let me explain in part why I'm sticking on this for a minute. I think I'm hilarious. I find myself very funny. And I will say that my beloved consistently tells me that I am the person who thinks that I am the funniest and that I should probably not laugh quite so hard before I even get the punchline out. So I'm wondering, like, when you're actually producing comedy and not just like basically singing in the shower, which is my version of comedy, like, what, how do you know you've hit it? You're like, yes, this is it. I've got this line right. I've got this delivery right.
Yeah. So for me, to be honest, my first priority is that I think it's hilarious. So I'm with you there. You know, every singer starts in the shower, right? But then once I'm laughing in my own house, then I have to go on stage. And I have a very specific strategy that I live by, where the moment I start performing, I look to find the audience member who likes me immediately, because I want them to continue liking me till the end of my set. And then I don't care how they feel. And then I want to find the person who likes me the very least. And if I hit a punchline and both of those people are laughing together, I win.
I love that. And I get that, right? I absolutely get, right? You want your, you want that audience member who's with you from the beginning and who's absolutely not with you. And if you got them both, then you've got it. That makes perfect sense to me. So I want to pivot just a little bit now to Dave Chappelle. Let's just start with something you told my producer, which was
a conversation.
I know, really. We'll come back to Pleasant in a moment. But you told my producer in part you didn't even want to watch this special. Can you tell me why?
I thought I knew what it was going to be. And I'm like, okay, Dave is going to say some stuff that's, you know, invalidating towards women. And he's going to go for, like, the cheapest trans jokes he can think of at the moment. So I just didn't need to. What I definitely didn't want to do, and what I have avoided doing for, let's see, he's been at this since 2017. So for the last 4 years, I have avoided responding to anything he has done because, like, right now, I think he owes me at least $3,000 in publicity. But yeah, I just knew what the special was going to be. I knew it wasn't going to be valid. I knew it was going to be intentionally insulting. And if I want to have my identity or existence called into question, I can just watch the news.
I'm interested in what you said a few moments ago about, you know, he probably owes me some thousands in publicity. And, you know, I'm not naive. I spend a little bit of time on the Twitter machine. And I think there are those, and you're not naive either, right, who claim that it's the opposite, that you are trying to make your career from writing about Dave Chappelle. You want to respond to that?
I do. So in the last 48, 72 hours, a lot of transgender writers and social media folk have been banned from our platforms or locked out of our platforms. I currently have no access to my main Instagram account. What Dave Chappelle achieved with his most recent special was a battle cry. It was a rallying cry for transphobes to come out of the woodwork and troll and bully and pressure transgender people to not speak, because Dave Chappelle is allowed to have absolutely any opinion. This is the argument they constantly make. You know, if you don't like Dave's opinions, then you don't have to listen. And yet they'll spend hours a day berating transgender people into silence for saying, we don't find Dave Chappelle funny anymore.
Is there a way to speak, to have voice, to not be silenced, but also not to have to center Dave Chappelle in your work?
Yeah, and I guess that's really the sticking point for me in all of this, because when people throw that accusation around of we're trying to make names for ourselves on Dave Chappelle's back or whatever, Dave Chappelle has already made $60 million on our lived experiences. He's made $60 million mocking us and calling us into question. And for Black queer people especially, and especially Black trans women, he has erased our existence very intentionally, very skillfully, for $60 million. And we've gotten nothing. So when trans comics only get the spotlight during controversies, I think that's really the issue. If we could reach a point where Netflix was reaching out to transgender comics to, like, have specials expressing the funny side of being trans, that would be fantastic. But if Dave Chappelle's voice is the only voice being heard for what the trans community is or what our experience is, then we are effectively being silenced. The only people being canceled are transgender people.
Dahlia, I want to play you a couple of classic moments in Black comedy.
The devil made me buy this dress. Said I didn't want to buy no dress. The devil kept following me. I was going down the street going, and the devil kept following me, and he kept telling me how good I look.
Oh, my goodness. If it isn't Little Miss Attitude, why are you always over here? I mean, don't you have a bag?
There we're hearing, you know, Flip Wilson, you know, as Geraldine, Martin Lawrence as Shanae. And I realize, you know, I grew up, Dahlia, in this house where what my father would say about moments like that is that these are Black male comedians who are being emasculated by having to wear a dress in order to be considered funny. But as I got older and really started to reflect on this, I thought, you know, maybe that's what's going on. But maybe the bigger issue here is that this is a kind of comedy that's making Black trans women invisible.
Yeah, and that is absolutely true. And applause to you for noticing. Yeah, I was very aware of that growing up. And I don't even want to say it's limited to cisgender, heterosexual Black men. It's really across the board. Like, you can look at movies like Tootsie or, you know, there are any number of titles. An actor appears in a dress eventually, right? Mm-hmm. And I knew from early childhood that that was funny. Or if you had a character who is understood to be a woman, but it turns out they're a man, you know, it's hilarious. Instantly. So yeah, it's very much beats this narrative into young queer people's heads that we are a punchline. And I guess, to be honest, in my opinion, that is why we're so good at telling jokes about ourselves, because we've literally heard every single one. So when a trans comic writes a trans joke, we are thinking, okay, what's the punchline? Why is my existence a joke? But how can I enjoy the joke too?
Mix Dahlia Bell, writer and comedian, thank you for joining us on The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Okay, y'all, I want to close this out with a few more listener calls about what defines the best in comedy to you.
There's a Scott from Martinez, California, and I think the best comedy is comedy that's unexpected, that's not obvious. And by obvious, I mean most of today's mainstream major network sitcoms and animated shows. I don't have any problem with the occasional, you know, take my wife, please, Catskill kind of humor. But these days, I think that comedy should have more of a purpose than just getting chuckles out of people.
I love satire and political comedy. The kind of sketch comedy that Saturday Night Live does is often pretty good and timely. I will confess I really enjoy slapstick and pratfalls as well. My favorite comic was Robin Williams. Today, I really enjoy Trevor Noah and Colbert and sometimes even Bill Maher. This is Susan from Vashon, Washington.
Hi, this is Rebecca from Fife, Washington. And the kind of humor I enjoy is the kind of humor that makes you think.
I find physical comedy funny, like Jim Carrey. Oh my gosh, his movies are hilarious, and his stand-up. And also smart stand-up, such as Eddie Izzard and Horse in a Hospital by John Mulaney just totally cracked us up. Thanks for asking me to record this. This is Deborah from Oregon.
This is Nick Rhodes calling from Dillon, Colorado. I have a favorite Pandora station that I started about 10 years ago with Jim Gaffigan, and it plays great comedians such as Brian Regan, Louis C.K., Aziz, Daniel Tosh. And then also other comedians, Dimitri Martin. His smart, obvious humor just always gets me. And John Mulaney and Kevin Hart are two others that are always favorites. Anybody that talks about parenting and just stuff that's funny because it's true, you've been there. That usually gets me. Thanks.
Hi, this is Brian from Tulsa. I like intellectual humor that is thought-provoking, but my favorite is by far British and dry humor. Think Monty Python's Flying Circus or The Goodies from the 70s.
Hi, my name is Nancy Summerman. I'm calling from Fort Worth, Texas. I like it when a comedian gives us a different perspective on life's events. Comedians like George Carlin and Paula Poundstone are my favorite.
Want to be a part of The Takeaway? Record your take as a voice memo on your phone. Email it to takeawaycallers@gmail.com and make your voice heard. Or call us at 877-869-8253.
I got my potato.
On Radiolab.
And I'm looking at it and I'm holding it.
We consider the mundane.
It's a handsome shape.
And stop to smell the potatoes.
Been telling people about my potato. They're always surprised and I say, you wouldn't understand.
Small potatoes on Radiolab.
It's my friend.
Listen wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and you're back on The Takeaway. America is aging. According to data from the Urban Institute, the number of Americans over age 65 will double in the next 40 years. The number of adults over 85, which is the group who most often needs assistance in daily life, will quadruple. And by 2040, there will likely be 80 million older Americans. Honestly, I kind of can't wait because my generation is lit and we are going to be some fabulous old folk. Now, to be clear, my girls and I will be solidly in the over 65 demo in 2040. And yes, we will still be rocking out to Beyonce. We like to party. Not only will our generation be the most racially diverse seniors in American history, we will also be the most openly queer. In the coming decades, an estimated 10 million older adults will be LGBTQ identified. And with the graying of gay America come unique intersectional challenges. So we're kicking off our new series here on The Takeaway, Aging While Queer. To get us started, we're joined now by Michael Adams, CEO of SAGE, the country's largest and oldest organization dedicated to improving the lives of LGBTQ older people. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, Melissa. It's good to be with you.
Can you tell us a little bit about some of the unique challenges facing LGBTQ elders?
Absolutely. Our elders in our community face a range of challenges, among them being very high levels of social isolation and thin support networks. And this comes in part from the fact that so many of our elders are not parents for lots of historical reasons. In fact, as we grow older, we're four times less likely to be parents than older Americans in general, and twice as likely to grow older single and living alone. And of course, we live in a society where adult children and partners and spouses are primary caregivers in old age. So the absence of them creates a lot of isolation and thin support networks, which means as we age as queer elders, we have a greater need for professional services and care. But unfortunately, what we find is that often when we seek to access that care, what we find is discrimination, ignorance, lack of cultural competency. And these challenges are worse for queer elders of color, for trans elders, in terms of higher levels of poverty and in terms of the intersectionality of discrimination based on identity and life experience. So these are some of the challenges that our elders face as they get older.
Yeah, it was occurring to me as we were working on the production of this segment, this that, you know, marriage equality has only been on the books since 2015. And marriage, even beyond the question of love, right, has been a question about the capacity to extend protective resources to those you love, things like your Social Security, so that if you know, live beyond your partner, that there are resources left to support your partner. And that is so brand new in queer communities that it means, right, not only the question of children, but even of lifelong partnership may not have extended those kind of fiscal supports.
Precisely. Well, marriage equality was a big breakthrough. Frankly, it came too late for many of today's elders in our community who are dealing with the accumulated impact of lifetimes of discrimination and marginalization in the same way that things like Social Security benefits accumulate, right? So if you're let into the door very late in life, sometimes that's just too late when it comes to financial supports and resources and the benefits that come with our country's so-called safety net, such as it is.
Now, also walk us a bit through discrimination, because I do think marriage equality is often a place where we both begin and end the conversation. And, you know, in a time when we're seeing LGBTQ youth being targeted by new legal restrictions, what are the kinds of vulnerabilities, like legal vulnerabilities, that still exist for LGBTQ elders?
Well, it's so important that we not end the conversation with marriage equality, because really for all of us, including our elders, it's just the beginning. And fundamentally, we still see substantial levels of discrimination against our elders. Let's start with housing. We know from both our experience at SAGE, and we work with tens of thousands of queer elders across the country, and from research, that there are very high levels of housing discrimination against our elders. In fact, a study several years ago found that 48% of LGBTQ older adults are subjected to discrimination when they apply for senior rental housing. 48%, that's an incredibly, incredibly high number. We also know there are high levels of discrimination against LGBTQ older folks in long-term care. And by that, I mean things like nursing homes, assisted living facilities, and things of that nature. These levels of discrimination mean that our elders have a justified fear in terms of how they will be treated in senior housing settings and elder care settings. And what that means for many of our elders is that they feel forced back into the closet as a self-protective mechanism, right? Because they're at a point in life where in many cases they may be more vulnerable, less able to advocate for themselves, and feel that they can't take on that additional vulnerability of being out. So this self-closeting dynamic takes place for many of our older folks, especially who are in institutional care or working with home care attendants, which is really a tragedy that has to come to an end.
All right, let's pick up on this question of long-term care, Michael. What is the Long-Term Care Bill of Rights?
So a Long-Term Care Bill of Rights is model legislation promoted by SAGE and now adopted in a number of states and jurisdictions around the country that guarantees that queer elders will be treated with the dignity and respect that they deserve when they're in long-term care settings like nursing homes, like assisted living. So the Long-Term Care Bill of Rights guarantees that our elders are protected from discrimination. It guarantees that their gender choices will be protected and respected in things like room assignments and in the pronouns that long-term care staff use, that they will use our folks' preferred pronouns. It guarantees that same gender loving relationships will be respected in long-term care and things of that nature. And so gradually we're seeing more and more states and jurisdictions, states like California, New Jersey, the District of Columbia, adopt these long-term care bills of rights in order to make sure that our elders are treated with just the fundamental respect they deserve in their later years if they're in long-term care.
Now, is that connected to the Equality Act?
It's absolutely connected to the Equality Act. The Equality Act is a proposed federal legislation that would provide federal anti-discrimination protections to queer elders all across this country in housing and elder care and elder services. And it is an essential bill that must be passed, because the challenge is, without the Equality Act, we have to enact these protections on a state-by-state basis. And I think we all know that in some parts of this country, that's going to be extraordinarily difficult. So the Equality Act is fundamentally important. It's been passed by the House of Representatives, and we're pushing hard to get the Senate to pass it as well.
So it's actually, I'm curious about whether or not you even have data on this issue. But as you say that, and you're talking about the state by state, as a Southerner, I'm thinking also a little bit about rural versus urban experiences. And, you know, we just lost my own godmother to Alzheimer's, and at the very end, she was in a long-term care facility, and we were navigating even the issues of race, you know, and in the South, in places where there are high populations of African Americans, but where you're still sort of in each facility trying to check and ensure that your elder will be cared for in a way that doesn't reflect, you know, again, those sort of generational biases. So I'm wondering, if you all know, either by region or by the urban-rural divide, where LGBTQ elders may be facing the harshest concerns in long-term care facilities.
I'm really glad that you're raising this question, Melissa, because in some ways it gets at the heart of an intersectional approach to this conversation around issues like race, like rural versus urban. So one thing, for example, there tends to be this misconception that queer folks live primarily or exclusively in urban areas. Not true. An AARP survey from several years ago showed that just under 30% of LGBTQ elders live in rural areas, and 9 out of 10 of them report that they have access to absolutely no queer-friendly services or care. And then we layer, right, we layer race and racism into that. And so we know, and of course, COVID put a spotlight on this in an incredibly dramatic way. We see tremendous disparities in health and healthcare, higher levels of discrimination. For example, during the COVID era, you referenced Alzheimer's. We saw that Black folks living with Alzheimer's are twice as likely to die from COVID as white people living with Alzheimer's. So these layers of experience, which include importantly where you live, both rural versus urban, and in what parts of the country, red versus blue or purple, and race, of course, tremendously complicate the experience that queer elders have as they age. And part of our policy agenda has to be to ensure that we enact things like the Equality Act and undertake other strategies to ensure that the progress we're making, the protections we're advancing, don't just reach queer elders in urban areas or in blue states or blue areas, but reach queer elders everywhere.
What can you tell us about the housing that SAGE provides in Fort Greene and in the Bronx in New York?
So one of the things that we hear from our elders is that some of the places where they feel least safe as LGBTQ people and the most need to hide who they are is where they live, right? Which is truly, truly wrong. So there is a movement in this country to create queer-specific, LGBTQ-focused elder housing with a strong focus on affordability. And SAGE has been part of the vanguard of that movement. And in recent years, we have built New York City and New York State's first two LGBTQ-friendly affordable housing developments, one in the Fort Greene neighborhood in Brooklyn, the other in the Crotona neighborhood in the Bronx. There are a variety of reasons why these two housing communities are important. But one of them is that we have been very intentional about locating these housing developments in historical communities of color, which is a departure from what has happened in other developments that more often than not were located in so-called gayborhoods, which were predominantly white. But the reality is the folks who most need this housing, in many instances, are queer elders of color. So we felt it was important to build this housing in the communities where our queer elders of color live.
Do you have good partners? Are there either legislative partners who are working at the state, local, or federal level who kind of get that, particularly as the boomer population is aging and along with the boomers, queer boomers are aging, and that there will be some specific needs and concerns?
We have outstanding partners. You know, among them, I would lift up in Congress Representative Suzanne Bonamici, Representative Bobby Scott in the House, Senator Bob Casey in the Senate. I also want to lift up Senator Lisa Murkowski, a Republican in the Senate, who has been a strong advocate and supporter for LGBTQ elders. And of course, we have many great partners in the advocacy world, from the American Society on Aging to AARP to the National Hispanic Council on Aging and the National Asian Pacific Center on Aging, the National Black Center on Aging. So we are fortunate to work with a strong network of partners. And of course, not to mention our partners at the grassroots and community level here in New York City, for example. We work closely with Griot Circle, which is the country's only autonomous BIPOC elder organization.
Michael Adams, CEO of Sage, thank you so much for your time and for kicking off our conversation. If you or a loved one is an aging LGBTQ community member and you don't know Sage, get to know Sage. You can go to sageusa.org. Michael, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa.
All right, folks, that's all we have for you today. Thanks for tuning in, and thanks so much for your calls. Hearing your unique perspectives always adds to the show. So continue to call in, and you might just hear yourself on The Takeaway. Our number is 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. And if you want to share all The Takeaway goodness on social media, pop on over to thetakeaway.org. Find the segment you just can't stop thinking about and post it right on your Facebook page. That'll keep the conversation going. So let us know what your network thinks. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Come on back for some politics tomorrow.